So today, the subject matter of what we're going to speak about is, it's your choice. And hi to everybody out there who's saying hi, all the little babies who are saying hi to all of you. And hi to everybody everywhere. I haven't seen you for 3 weeks, my goodness, long time. I've had a very interesting 3 weeks from many points of view. And one of the more interesting points of view has been instigated by the discussion by Parampara Pamu on the forum of HariMedia.net. The situation was instigated by the feeling that perhaps existential crisis become part of one's life suddenly and unexpectedly. And I know that in my life, I have often experienced these existential crises. Now, of course, I suppose there's many ways you can define what an existential crisis is. But crisis, of course, we all know what that means. It means when something is suddenly there that you have to deal with that is not of the usual and that's very difficult to deal with. It's a very powerful situation. But the harder part to define is the term existential. I mean, how do you deal with an existential crisis? I mean, after all, what does existential really mean? Now, there have been many books and many discussions trying to define the term existential. But generally, when we speak about an existential thing, we're talking about something which is referring to one's basis or foundation of life, or something which affects one's very fundamental existence. The French actually have a very good term for it. They call it raison d'être. Now, if you were to translate that specifically in English, you could say something like reason for existence, or reason, the purpose of life. Now, everybody at one point or another has to deal with this in themselves. They ask questions like, why am I here? What's the point of it all? I know trying to understand what's the reason for our existence, what's the purpose of our existence, is very high on everybody's list of, I really want to know. Understanding things is often not very easy, because there are so many factors in life that we don't control. And yet, at the same time, there are many things that we do control. And of these things, the one most significant, most powerful, and most important ingredient is our choice. Choice is an extremely important aspect of our life because it directs all things in our life. Now, of course, choice is depending on the decisions we make, which are based on all of the things we think and feel and the way we are in our consciousness. But if you think about it, our choice is really based upon our purpose of existence. Now, I know that this is not a conscious thing. This is not something that is very much in our consciousness at every moment in time. After all, in our everyday life and the way we deal with the world and the way in which we understand our situations, we don't walk around questioning, why am I here? What is my purpose? What is the goal that I'm to fulfill? But actually, when you get really into it deep down, what you feel is a certain kind of balance within your life, a certain kind of comfort in your life. This feeling of what we are as living beings is really what dictates everything that takes place within our choices, within our actions, within our feelings. So ultimately, what we are actually is our deciding factor in everything we do. And our characteristics, our qualities, our values, and so on, color and guide us in every way. Now, the problem comes when we have these doubts in ourselves. We feel uncertain. What are we actually? When we have these thoughts within us that, is this right? Am I Is there a purpose, or am I just lost in existence? Now, it's not that you have these existential crises all the time, but in those few times you do have these crises, they are very deep because they are right at the bottom of what we are as people. It makes us just wonder about so many things in our lives. Sometimes we walk around and we go, what's the point of it all? Why am I doing what I'm doing? What is really the purpose of anything that I do? Some people conclude the purpose of life is simply to suffer and nothing else. So they build a philosophy based on this, which is meant to push away life in all of its aspects to avoid pain. Others have a philosophy, the purpose of life is to enjoy as much as you can. And they build a philosophy upon simply maximizing sense gratification. Many others are not at all sure about anything. They cannot say the purpose of life is this, the purpose of life is that. So they don't build up a philosophy about anything. I mean, in my personal case, as you all know, I used to think that everything was a certain kind of a way, and I felt very secure in that. I didn't have that many existential crises because all the questions were answered. But, you know, there is a certain amount of illusion in that idea. That certain amount of illusion is that anything we can do can have all the answers to every aspect of our lives. And after a while, even in what I was doing, there were many doubts. There were many questions. Is this right? How can this be right? How can this make sense? How can this actually succeed? Carmela Mala, can you fix your camera again? I'm getting a great shot of your bookcase. So after a while, when you understand this, that there'll always be points at which you question what you're doing, you start to see things differently. Now, in some situations, one is taught to fear doubt, to fear uncertainty. That fear that comes from uncertainty or doubt is certainly born of ignorance and nothing else, or maybe even passion. Well, I don't believe that. I don't think that's so. In fact, I personally believe that doubt and uncertainty are healthy in many respects. To wonder about what you're doing, to always reassess your situation, to look at it from different points of view. This is a healthy thing. And therefore, because of that feeling of uncertainty or that feeling of possible doubt, it's important that one always leave oneself open or allow oneself to go through this process of facing existential crisis when it comes without fear or disgust. In other words, to simply understand that doubt is a symptom of intelligence. It is not a symptom of some kind of foolishness or disrespect or any other term. It's a symptom that you have the vision to see that things aren't always perfect in your world. In the utopian absolute realm, one always feels that there is an absolute you can depend on. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that we don't live in that absolute perfect realm. We live in this realm where things are filled with uncertainty all the time, where there's so-called imperfections in all actions and all things. Therefore, when we make choices, we are filled with difficulties in our lives. Now, if you think about something which I always felt was a really wonderful part of the Mahabharata, the time when Draupadi came to Bhishma and Drona and asked for help. After she had been lost in the gambling match, and she was being stripped naked. So she appealed to the older and wiser personalities, Drona and Bhishma, to save her, to stop this brute from doing what he was doing. Now, interestingly enough, when she did that, She didn't get the reaction she thought she would get. She thought she would get a warm assistance from people who were not only wise, but filled with love for her. Instead, she met thoughtfulness on the part of these two personalities. Now, sometimes people who read this start to judge and criticize Bhishma or Drona for what they did. Now, that is a very big mistake. It is a big mistake, first of all, because judging others is just not good for you or anyone else. And condemning somebody for the choices they make is not a good practice, because you will end up in that situation yourself someday. I have seen that whenever in my life I have ended up judging or condemning somebody for something they did, I always ended up sharing their experience inexplicably later on and finding myself in a very similar situation. And after these experiences, I've come to lose all interest in judging or condemning others for the choices they make. Now, many people say what Bhishma did, what Drona did, was wrong. This was a wrong choice. Now, these are very, very, very dreamly intelligent people. They are learned, they are experienced, they are transcendentalists of the highest order. They really know what they're doing. Yet, from the point of view of history, all the good guys are over there behind Draupadi, the Pandavas, and then the other guys these are the bad guys, so to speak. There was the good and there was the bad. And all the good guys won, and all the bad guys were killed, including Bhishma and Drona, because they were bad guys, quote unquote. Now, that is the typical simplistic understanding of things that causes us to get in trouble personally and have to face similar situations in our own lives later on. We can apply one principle, or let's put it this way, if we apply this one principle in our lives for seeing things, it transforms the way we see ourselves and others. If we, for example, to see this one thing, which is, everybody does what they think is right at the time they do it. That's the most important point to understand. Everybody is doing the thing they think is right. Now, I know this is hard to understand, especially when you consider the implication, but even somebody who purposefully does something they think is wrong is doing something they thought was right. They thought it was right to purposefully do it wrong at that moment. In other words, they've made a choice, they've made a decision based on their own desires, their own capacities, their own intelligence, and they are choosing it because they feel it is the best thing for them to do right at the point they have to do it. Now, 1 second later, you may think, oh, that was wrong. Maybe 1 year later, you may think, oh, that was wrong. Maybe one lifetime later, you may think, oh, that was wrong. But that's what you thought later. Even if 1 second after you've done it, you realized it was wrong, it's still after the moment the decision had to be made. You have no control over 1 second in the future. You can't control that second in the future. Your only capacity is to deal with the right now. So therefore, when you make a choice, have faith in yourself that you are trying to do the right thing. Wait, that wasn't exactly correct. I said the right thing. I should have said the best thing. There is a discussion people use nowadays to do the right thing. This is a phrase, to do the right thing, meaning to do something which is morally correct or politically correct or socially correct or religiously correct, something which is right. That may not even relate to what's right for me. It's right because it's best for all. Now, when we speak about that right thing, We're talking about some abstract principle that may or may not be relative to me. It's some righteousness which exists, which we accept, which is socially acceptable, and like I said. But when we speak about doing the best thing, we include, perhaps, doing the right thing, if that's the way you feel, because some people don't care about doing the right thing. When we talk about doing the best thing, we talk about what is best for me right now, considering what should be done or what could be done or what's good for me, including what's good for you, and mixing that all together and coming up with a decision. So Bhishma and Drona, they did what they felt was right. And because they were the kind of people who always wanted to be on the side of what was right, they thought it was also best for them to do it. After all, they were basically working for or employed by Duryodhana. He was in charge of the government. The gambling match was a fair one. They thought, they didn't know about the loaded dice. And the result was one which everybody knew could have taken place. And therefore, in all righteousness, according to the moment, what could they do? Were they happy about making such a decision? Absolutely not. They didn't like to do anything at the time, and afterwards they felt lousy about it, you can be sure, but they had no other choice but to be wishy-washy when Draupadi was asking them for help. She asked them, help me from religious principles, from the point of view of I'm a woman. And they said, it is very difficult to determine what is right to be done in this case according to religious principles. There are so many religious principles that they even contradict each other at different points. Sometimes we get so confused with all these religious principles that we lose ourselves. Even Arjuna started quoting religious principles as he sat on his chariot before the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and on the basis of the religious principles didn't want to fight. So just consider, there are a lot of problems when it comes to doing what is best, doing what is right, and making a decision, making a choice. But the amazing thing about this world is you cannot not make choices. The very nature of life is that it's moment by moment choices that we make. Okay, in some situations, maybe somebody decides to just go to sleep and not do anything for a long time. Yeah, but that's also a choice. Maybe he puts aside that choice making, continuous choice making while he's sleeping, but he made the choice to try to get away from all choices. And sometimes the choices we have to make are so mind-boggling that they throw us into existential crises. We don't know what to do. Sometimes we don't even know why we should do it. It causes us to spin inside, not spin in the head. Existential crisis does not mean confusion. Don't make that mistake. Just because you're having a crisis doesn't mean you're confused. You could be very clearly trying to work your way through that crisis, but still that doesn't make the crisis any easier. And being in an existential crisis doesn't also mean you're an illusion or you're deluded. Periods of existential crisis can also be opportunities to redefine yourself into a better version of what you are. To redefine yourself to growth, to evolution, beyond something that you were stuck in. And it's funny for me personally, when I don't have these opportunities to do these discussions with you on Saturday, I go through these existential crises. What's the point of my life? Now, really, really funny, I had to go to the doctor yesterday. I have some infection. I have to take some antibiotic and junk. But before I knew that, I go to this doctor here in Gainesville. And, you know, we're talking about my thing. And then all of a sudden, he starts talking to me about idealism and altruism and working for the sake of others. And he asks me, do you agree with the statement that the only real purpose in life is to be of service for the sake of others? I said, sure. So I go to a doctor who's having an existential crisis that he's sharing with me, who's also having an existential crisis about the exact same thing. And the amazing thing was, I think we were the exact same age, too. So I think these existential crises are very welcome things. Because when you have them, and you go through them, you work with them, at the end, you grow. Because making sense of the redefinition that we go through, making sense of this self-defining process, which is an ongoing thing, gives one great strength. It flexes the muscles of the being. It gives you insight in all of its implications. Insight to see in. The capacity to look in and clarify that which makes you tick. I had some existential crisis for a long time. What is it that makes me tick? But it seemed that in this period of 3 weeks where we have not gotten together, it's so clear what makes me tick is being of service to you. Therefore, I wanted to share with you this whole thing about crisis, existential crisis, about making decisions and choices, and actually coming to this conclusion again from another way, around another direction. You know how it comes in different ways to you again. I find it very interesting when you take your life and then you take this big existence that you've become more aware of and you have to apply it in itsy bitsy little moments of time when you have to decide what do you do in the next moment. It's amazing how this big, big beingness that we are has to be all utilized in total to just figure out one itsy bitsy little choice at the next moment. Now, some people say, and rightfully so, according to certain understandings, that life should be lived in goal-oriented ways. You can say, like, for example, I have a mission statement of my life. My life has a mission statement. My mission of life, to me personally, is to be of service to others, to help them to gather the tools they need to grow and become really wonderful persons that they are. Now, these personal mission statements are things which are directly connected to you as an essence of spirit, your spiritual essence. They are not something that changes very fast. In fact, it may change over lifetimes. But the goals that we set to come to this mission, to fulfill this mission, these are goals that we set to accomplish in a daily basis, in an hourly basis, or in a monthly or yearly or even five-year plan or whatever. We have a plan that we set up. So creating these goals and fulfilling these goals to get to the mission, in other words, to use these goals as steps in fulfilling the mission, this is normal and a very, it's an optimal way to fulfill your mission of life. But creating your own personal mission statement, this is a very, very difficult thing to do. It's a very, very significant thing. It's not easy to do it. It is something which relates to your very essence, your very being, the fundament of your whole life. And in all of these existential crises that we have, what we really are doing is we are contacting again and affirming again our mission statement. And if our mission statement wasn't correct, we have to adjust it. In other words, existential crises are part of the process of refreshing and renewing our mission statement of life. Knowing that doesn't make it any easier and doesn't make the existential crisis any shorter. But it does one very important thing, which is really, I would say, very valuable for us to know. It makes us understand there's a point to it. There's a reason for this existential crisis. It's not just some pain coming to us from the heavens. When you know there's a point to something, when you know there's a reason for it, you can deal with it a lot easier than when you think it's just mindless. It has no point. It has no purpose. It's just random acts of chance. So when one understands that these existential crises are part of the process of growing, are part of the process of renewing our existence on a spiritual level, we can embrace them and try to make the most of these crises. But the mission statement, that's everybody can agree on that. There's no real problem with that. It's just these goals that we have these difficulties. No. You have nobody really has difficulty with this mission statement. In other words, we can redefine it, we can make it better, and so on. But it's the goals that we choose to get to fulfill that mission statement which can give us a lot of difficulty and cause us to really collapse in many ways. For example, let's say you want to be of service, yet you choose particular pathways, a particular work that you wish to be of service with, and you really devote yourself to that particular way of doing it. You know what I'm talking about. We devoted ourselves totally to some spiritual work we thought would help others, and we had many goals to fulfill, many accomplishments to make, and we did that pretty well. But sometimes when you're doing such goals, you forget the reason you're doing them. You forget what's the point of it all. You're so busy acting, you forget about the real point. And when you forget about the real point, the things you are doing as goals might even be working against the real point without your being conscious of it. I see, and I will always see, that the way kids were dealt with in ISKCON, for instance, these decisions that were made were parts of the goal process which had no connection to the mission statement. So you get the idea where you can become so absorbed in goals that you forget why you're doing them. Yet while you are doing what you are doing, you think that you are doing the right thing. You think you are making the right choices. And because everybody is thinking that way, everybody thinks they are doing the right thing at the time they do it, you cannot condemn anybody for what they have done. However, you can, right now, change as much as you can to make it right those things which you now know to be wrong. Sometimes people want to drag you back into the past so that you have to talk about, defend, and discuss all things that took place in the past. But this is not a very useful discussion. Because if I am to be honest about myself, I will be able to say, well, I did that because I thought it was the right thing to do then. Was I ignorant then, or were others ignorant then, or was something wrong then, or were we following something improper then? Sure, all these possibilities are there. But the only real freedom we have right now is to do something right now, to do now what we think is the best thing, just as then we did what we thought what was the best thing. That doesn't mean that in 1 second from now, 1 year from now, 1 lifetime from now, or whatever, we might look back and say, well, that wasn't right either. But since life is all about trying to figure out what's the best choice to make right now, we have no choice but to keep on going trying to make the best choice. Therefore, one should always be very aware of what's happening right now, considering the context of the past, considering our mission statement of how we wish to be, and considering goals which we could fulfill in the future according to some plan we conceive of to fulfill our mission in life. I don't think that Bhaktivinoda, when he said, forget the past that sleeps, meant that you don't take lessons from history. I know he didn't mean it because he often referred to the glorious past of India's history. But the past should be seen as a lesson or as a resource of what works and what doesn't work under certain circumstances. And to adjust life right now, to adjust ourselves right now, according to what we have understood to be better, and choose to do that now to prepare even a better future. But this is all very goal-oriented. There are others who see everything in terms of right now, with complete detachment from the past, without any desire for the future. All they are concerned with is this awareness of the now, and to simply flow through life with love and awareness in the very present, ever-existing moment. And to just fill that moment with their love and service to others. And weird as I am, I agree with both points of view, and I don't see them contradictory anyway. I see getting with the present, it's great, and when I need to, I dive into the past just to examine, to understand what to do now. And when I have to plan, okay, I'll plan and get right back into the moment now. But it is most fun to be right now, in the moment right now, with full awareness and experience of what is in reality. That is what's before us right now. So if I can just review this subject very rapidly about it's your choice. It's your choice to understand what has happened in the past, what you wish to happen in the future, and how you think it's absolutely best to act right now to make a balance between all these things. So this is a very simple point, and I wonder why I talk so much about it, but I hope I didn't bore anyone today, but it's just what I felt like talking. So it's also your choice to ask questions if you like. I have here a question. It's actually a question which I have thought of course, maybe not the same amount of time that the questioner has. Definitely, I have shared the concern of this question. Somehow your voice got lower. For some reason it got. Let me raise you here. Speak. Yeah. A little more. That question is, this person who asked the question says that existential crisis is a great chance to get some new in life. And during half of her life, she worked with these crises quite successfully. But what to do now when facing the longest, deepest, and most boring crisis where you feel indifferent and a lack of desire to do anything more? Well, you know, I feel kind of the same way sometimes. So I don't know if I'm a great expert to give you a good answer. Sometimes I feel that, dealing with boredom is a real test. It's a real test because it's not like pain, where you have to spend a lot of time dealing with pain. And it's not like pleasure, where you can absorb yourself in nice things to do. It's like just simply boredom. It's like the worst of the worst. Now, the interesting thing about boredom in that sense is that it can make you either freeze up, like in do very little, or it can make you become very fiery. It just depends on who you are. Some people, they cool off. Some people, they boil up. Very few people just remain the same. So for those who are cooling off, a solution would be to get boiled up, to fire up. For those who are too fired up, a solution would be to cool off. Now, I know that sounds kind of like common sense, you know, grandma kind of wisdom. But actually, there's a depth to that there, which is in attaining some balance in life. If you are of the, maybe you could just come and type in whether you're the cool off or the boil over type, and then I can answer the question better. Just do it, a really quick answer, because everybody's waiting. Just do cool off or boil over. Okay, she's a cool off lady. I'm also a cool off. So we share that too. And for us cool off people, the only solution is to boil up a little. And to boil up a little, well, that just depends on what makes you feel more fired up. And you have to not be afraid to figure out those things which give you some passion in life. And to not be afraid to experiment until you find out what those things are so that you can correct that lack of passion in your life. It's like your life becomes a laboratory. It's like you're in a chemical laboratory and you have this ice in this test tube and you don't really know what it's going to take to deal with this ice. So you have to put various chemicals in or you have to try various sources of energy. You find out exactly what it takes to make this thing boil a little. Because for such persons, just getting the energy flowing again, just getting the energy flowing, it doesn't matter how, just getting the energy flowing is most important because afterwards, you can get it to flow in the right way, you know? But first you got to get it flowing. Then you can make it flow in a very productive way that you like. And usually us cool off people, we're all afraid to do anything even slightly fiery because we kind of get like, oh, that's fiery, oh. But sometimes you just got to say, you know, let's just try this. Let's just get into something, anything. Let's just get fired up about something and then we can just start doing again. We can live again. We can experience again. Now, I'm not going to start giving you ideas of what to do here in this public forum. You're just going to have to use your own imagination and figure out things that could possibly fire you up. And once you get some juice flowing in you, then you can figure out what to do. Does that make sense? You can nod your head. And for you fiery persons out there who have just the opposite problem, that's what these real nice meditation techniques and relaxation techniques and all these kinds of like, you know, going and sitting in nature and just coming in contact with yourself by just cooling off. That's very useful for you because then you become more productive instead of just sanely running around crushing the universe. And then there's another question. There's a person who... Here, I'll try to put it in a better... This person is a person who always considers the last choice after 1 second as wrong. And then he says, probably that's because he doesn't want to predict the future. Now he's asking, why is it that I don't want to predict the future? Well, that's a very interesting question because it goes beyond the usual question one would ask. Usually somebody would just say, oh, I always think what I do is wrong and, you know, it's because I'm just have no faith in anything I do, or maybe I always do the wrong thing. But here it's saying, why is it that I'm afraid of the future? That's actually the key to the answer. There are many people who are afraid of the future because they really don't have any faith in it. They have experience in their lives that something they are doing or something they are doing... Or, we lost the recording. There we go. Alright, let me start again in another way. Sorry for interruption there. If you're afraid of the future, you never want to know what it really is going to be. You're always afraid that it's going to be something horrible. Or, you're convinced it's going to be something horrible, and you're always trying to convince yourself it won't be something horrible. Therefore, you never really want to know what's going to happen. Or, seen just the other way around, you really want to know what's going to happen so that you can do something now to prevent something awful from happening because you're convinced something awful is going to happen. Now, in either case, one is not acting with confidence. One is not acting with, in a flowing way because one is restricted by some fear about the future. If one is convinced the future will not be good, one is also convinced that the decisions you make now are not the right ones. Unless you're the kind of a person who has the philosophy that everything's going to be bad no matter what I do. In that case, there's no need to try to do something right. But if you're not that kind of person, and I don't think you are, then you have to see it as a great fear about what will happen because of my choices. Now let's think about that for a second. If you're always afraid about the future because you feel that your choices are going to end up with something lousy, you are subconsciously programming yourself to do something wrong now. It becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You feel it's going to be bad in the future unless you do the right thing now, but you have no faith that you can do the right thing now, and you fear that there's going to be a bad future, so you create a bad future just so you'll be right by doing the wrong thing now. And as soon as you do it, immediately you understand, of course it was wrong. I knew it was wrong. That's why 1 second later I know it's wrong, because I only did it just to fulfill the prophecy to make it wrong, make it worse in the future. Sometimes I do that too. It's just a question of, you know, you don't have enough faith in yourself. We have problems as human beings of not having enough faith in ourselves. And when we don't have enough faith in ourselves, our decisions are influenced by this lack of faith. So therefore, the solution to this particular problem is to have enough faith in yourself to know that you're going to do the best thing, the right thing, and get in a good place. Just have that long-term faith. And I hope that answer helped. Did it? Okay, good. Now we have another question in the other Moscow place. Where should we take the strength for us to use in the present moment? Well, that's a very interesting question. I'm not exactly sure how you're going to answer that, because it depends on what you know. When you know where to take strength, then you do it naturally. When you don't know, it becomes a big mystery. I found during my times of existential crisis, my times of feeling lack of confidence, even just to absorb the color violet, the way even Jasmine was to absorb it through the heart, the color violet, and feed all the cells with it. I find that to be very, very useful. I find this color violet absorbed through the heart chakra and then spread throughout the body to all the cells becomes such a source of strength because it replenishes my energy in all ways. Do you know that even if you are physically weak, you don't have the capacity to do, even if you know you should do something, your brain doesn't work properly, your cells don't work properly, you have no capacity to even do it. But actually, getting strength in the present has a lot to do, a lot more than you would imagine, in your own personal confidence in yourself. Actually, to be quite honest, this morning I had no confidence in me whatsoever. I had no confidence that I would be able to figure out what to talk about today. I was completely disturbed about this. And because of that, I felt very weak. So when I was setting up the broadcasting and I was typing in the title, I said, well, the only thing I can do is just ask everybody to ask questions. So I put in, it's your choice, thinking that I would mean, well, you're going to have to tell me what to do. But then I realized about 10 minutes later, wait a minute, that's a really cool thing to talk about, your choice. And then I thought, you know, why can't I just admit I'm going through existential crisis and use it as part of my discussion? I mean, after all, it's what I've realized the deepest, that I have such crisis. And it seemed to go quite well. So as soon as I was sure of this, then I felt very comfortable with it and I got a lot of confidence. And when I got confidence, I got a lot of strength. So I really feel that confidence, strength to act in the present moment are very intimately related. Does that help over there? Does that help answer the question? You can nod yes or no? Okay, good. Now we have Argentina asking. I'll get to Vajra's question afterwards. He's asking, or somebody's asking there, what about our long-term objectives that contradict our future plans? I'm not sure. There is some long-term objective that sometimes is not in accordance with the actual present time. Okay, I think what is being asked here is that what about our goals and our short-term, medium-term goals that may be contradictory, we think, to our future plans or long-term plans? In other words, if in my long-term desire I want to be of service to others, yet I myself am not very together, then to simply go out and be of service to others may be of disservice to these people. And therefore, my immediate goal has to be in tune with my long-term goals or my mission. It's obvious that you have to become a qualified person in yourself before you can assist others. That's just obvious. That's common, obvious sense. And if that means that you have to do any number of things to feel stable in your life, to feel that you have enough knowledge in your life, enough experience in your life, and you also have enough facility in your life, then do that. Just don't make the mistake of thinking you have to do these things all the time. You get so absorbed in getting all this stability and facility that that becomes the goal of your life and you forget all about other things. So as you are speaking about making a balance, and that is correct. You have to get something for you. You have to get yourself together. When you feel that strength or when you feel there's a need that you can fulfill, then you go for it. That's normal. That's fine. And never be afraid to say when another person requires something from you that you really cannot supply because of lack of qualification or strength. Never be afraid to say, I'm sorry, I cannot do that right now. That's over my head. Give what you can according to what you are and know your limit and respect your limit. I hope that helped. Okay, and then I have a question here from Moscow. This is a very typical question of astrologers. Astrologers can drive themselves insane with paranoia. They figure out in the chart and they know, I've got this transit and this bad period in that house, and it means... And they walk around thinking, the planets are going to get me, the planets are going to get me. I remember a very interesting situation where somebody I knew had the absolute worst transits you could possibly imagine, all going to happen, three of them, at the same exact time in 1 month. And this was like really serious stuff. So this person was chewing their fingernails right down to their knuckles. There's no way I can deal with this. Oh, I'm so afraid. What will happen? What will happen? All the time. Now, we're talking here about really, really, really serious transits with the most powerful planets involved. And I swear, when those transits came, nothing really serious happened. Nothing. It manifested in completely different ways. After that, I realized probably the worst curse is to be an astrologer and look at your chart all day and figure out when all these horrible things are going to happen and then go crazy and pull out your hair and chew down your nails in fear and paranoia. And I've even seen where somebody is very expert at knowing the influence of the planet. As soon as that influence comes in, they go, aha, there it is. I knew it. Now it is going to happen. It's not necessarily so. And you just have to have faith enough in yourself to understand that it doesn't have to follow rules like that. And just by going with it, you should understand what these transits or these periods are there to teach you, what you can learn from them, how you can grow from them. And instead of seeing them with fear, have confidence in yourself that you will use them for the right purposes. Did that help answer the question? You can just stick your face in front of the camera or write a letter. Or do you want to know more about it? Do you want to know more? But you have to ask what you want to know more about. You got to write it. Right. If you want to know more. You know, it's funny. People who go to medical school, they study all the medical journals. They learn about all the diseases. And it's an absolute fact that as they're going through medical college, they tend to take on the symptoms of all the diseases. They think they have this disease they just studied, or, oh no, I've got that. So it's a dangerous thing to know. One has to be a little bit more confident. I'll get back to the astrology question there. Right now I'm going to, while it's being typed in, But, oh, there it is. Okay, all right. Unfortunately, often the bad predictions turn out to be true. How can I myself change the situation, or more or less what to do about it? How do you do that? Okay, that's fair enough. Because sometimes, absolutely sometimes, the bad things do happen. For example, let's say you've got this kind of like aspect that's coming at a certain time that says you could have difficulties with travel or injury or something like that. You do not plan travel at that time. You avoid it. Obviously you know that, and obviously one should act like that, because if you believe in what you're doing, then you should just prepare accordingly. But don't get hysterical about it. That's the point. You do your best. You try your best to make things work in the best way they can. And you just hope for the best and do what you can. That's all you can do. You can't make every painful situation disappear by your own will. Sometimes you have to just face them. Sometimes people who spend their whole lives trying to avoid pain are those who attract the pain the most to them. It's just like saying, I don't want pain, I don't want pain, I don't want pain. All the time you're thinking pain, pain, pain. So naturally, because you've got this vibration of pain, you'll say, hey, there's somebody. And if you're worry, 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 what will be, what will be, what will be, the future will bring you many things to worry about as a reciprocation. And if you are confident, no matter what happens, I can get through this because I'm a good person and I will do the best thing, then you can. So have some confidence in yourself. I have another question here from Argentina, but I am not sure what that question really is. I'm kind of being asked to give you some advice on how to absorb all these things that you get in your lives that are good and beneficial for you. I don't think that I can help you absorb better by giving you a phrase or an answer or some easy concept. It's something that you have to accept yourself. You know, like for my dog, it's hot out, so I get the bowl of water and I put in nice cool water and I put it there in front of him. And I pick him up and I stick him right in front of the water. And then even sometimes I splash a little on his nose. But if he doesn't want to drink that water, nothing I do, nothing I say gets him to drink that water. Now, I am not saying that this is totally analogous. What I am saying is that our desire, our intention is incredibly powerful when it comes to developing and accepting and growing with this knowledge. It is incredible the power of our own intention. Now, if you really intend before you do something, let's say, I really intend that this is going to really affect me deeply in a positive way, you will get the most out of the experience. I'll give you another example from a dream therapy. There are dream therapists who say that if before you go to sleep, you really intend on having a dream which will help clarify a certain situation, after a while you can start asking for and receiving. So this intention is so powerful that it even works when you're asleep. Now, I'm not saying this is the case with you. But there is the possibility that you can intend, that you can say you're intending to develop by a certain process, but really you're not. Therefore, it bounces off of you. It doesn't really absorb in you. And therefore, I can answer your question by saying the most important thing you've got to do as somebody who is receiving these gifts of wisdom, from wherever you get them, books, or you hear somebody somewhere, or you learn from your experience, is to be very, very aware of what it is you feel and how it is you are reciprocating or communicating with the message that is coming to you. Be totally aware of that. Because when you do that, you will then understand when you really want to get something and when you don't want to get something. And then you'll be honest about it. You'll say, I'm not interested in that, but I am very interested in that. And when you are interested, you won't have this am I interested or not business, which you don't, causes you not to hear. When you know you're interested, you'll go, I want to know that. And you'll be all ears and all heart. Otherwise, if you're not aware, then what happens is that when you are receiving something, your mind and heart are going, is this interesting? Is this not? Do I want? Do I not? Is it what or is it not? Or what is it or what can it be? I doubt. I don't know. I'm not concentrated. I'm spinning in the head to some extent. And therefore, I don't take it. And when you don't have that doubt and you don't have that agitation in your head, do I want it or not, which is really the essence of it, and you know, well, I don't, then you don't worry about it. And when you know, I do, then you concentrate on it, and then you accept it. Let's use an example which is probably, I don't know, maybe radical, but I'll just chance it. Let's say some girl comes up to you and says, oh, you are just the most handsome man in the whole of Buenos Aires. I want you. And let's say in your mind, you've got all these like things going on. You're like thinking, you know, well, I don't know if I like her or not. And I'm afraid of this or that. Or maybe I'll get in trouble. You can't really say, yeah. But when you're don't have all these problems, and you get such an opportunity, you jump on it, literally. And by your reaction, I see you understand this example very well. So accepting of these gifts that are given to you, however they may be given, all boils down to whether you want them or not. And you are aware of what you want or not. So I think that's the best answer I can possibly give. I hope it's good enough. Okay. I have another question here from Moscow that God also made fear and it has its purpose in evolution. So why is this fear there? What's the point of it? And how does it help us evolve? Sure, it has a purpose. The purpose is to learn to be fearless. But learning to be fearless means to be aware of the quality of fear and what that quality, what control or what effect that quality has on us, what it makes us turn into, what it does to us. Now, fear has the quality of existing on its own. It doesn't necessarily need some particular object to exist. For example, if somebody is really expert at emanating energy, really knows how to emanate energy, they can emanate out an energy that others should be afraid of. Others should be afraid of. Let's use the example of a guard dog or a big dog, a ferocious dog who is expressing by barking and teeth that you should be afraid. You should be afraid. If you ignore that and refuse to be afraid at all, then you have a very good chance of avoiding all fearful situations because you didn't accept the fear. I remember there was this situation. I was walking in the park where we used to live in Sweden, and this big dog was running around without a leash. And all of a sudden, this big dog decided it didn't like me and started running towards me. And I realized this is one mighty big dog. So I had been taught in some other discipline that when a dog is attacking you like that, the smartest thing to do is simply turn around and simply stand there without making any motion or acknowledging it in any way, simply showing it your back. So I did that. I turned around, and this monster dog just throws himself right at my back and bounces off and then growls and then turns around and walks away. In many situations, not all of them, but in many situations, you can deal with fear by simply not accepting it. In many situations, fear is in the mind. Not in all of them. Sometimes there is something to be afraid of, and fear does have its purpose in telling you to get out of the situation. This is called fight or flight phenomena, that when something fearful comes, the adrenal glands start pumping out some hormones which cause us to either decide rapidly whether we're going to fight the fear or we're going to run from it. It's very primal in every body. For example, if you're in a house and a tree is falling through the roof and you hear the roof cracking like this and you know you got like about 5 seconds left, well, that fear you feel like, is to get you right out of the room as fast as you can. Or if a big lion is running after you, you're not going to turn your back and say, I'm not afraid of you. You're going to go up the first tree you can. So there are situations where fear is very healthy. We say fear is not healthy when it's in a situation which would be better off ruled by love. For example, when it's time to deal with people or family members or whatever. So fear has its value. Learning to conquer fear has its value. But knowing when to conquer fear and knowing when to take it seriously is very important as well. So I'm sure all of this is favorable for our evolution.